Let's talk a little bit about the Four Noble Truths. You know the Four Noble Truths? What would you say they were?
You want to share this so everybody has a chance to see?
Yeah. What do you think?
The truth of suffering.
The truth of suffering.
The noble truth of suffering.
Noble truth of suffering. And what is that actually?
Suffering is.
So I would say that life is inherently unsatisfactory. What actually is it that's unsatisfactory?
It's like you always want the good things and you don't want the bad things, so always like caught in the middle of that.
That's certainly one aspect. Life is inherently irritating.
The good stuff doesn't last.
Good stuff doesn't last.
Incapable of satisfying.
Right.
Uncertainty.
Uncertainty.
The groundlessness.
So, old age, sickness, death, separating, being separated from the people that you love, not getting what you want, getting what you want and losing it.
Getting what you don't want, of course, that's all included in the other.
Getting what you don't want.
Old age and illness is what you don't want.
Well, I thought the kale salad that I ordered would be really delicious and I didn't like it.
Yeah. That's right.
Not getting what you want.
Right. There are certain presidents I have not preferred.
There are moments of unsatisfactoriness and moments of great fulfillment. Yeah. And those moments also exist. And I, for one, don't feel like because they aren't eternal, they're crap.
No, there's no suggestion of that.
Yeah. Or they're
simply
not.
That they don't last.
But yeah.
Hard to argue that.
Yeah.
That it's not that it's crap, it's that it's unsatisfactory.
Well, there are moments.
But that's where attachment comes in.
Well, it might.
Right. Well, the tendency to grasp, as Buddha Dosa said, grasp like a thief trying to get something that they want. Or clinging like a thief who's stolen something that they want, knowing that in each moment it passes. In that moment of grasping is the suffering. In that moment of clinging is the suffering. If you're perfectly fine having something that's pleasant and then letting it go, then there's no suffering. But that's the second. That the cause of suffering is clinging to what is inherently unsatisfactory. And the third?
There's an end.
There's a way out. And the fourth?
The path.
The way out. All right. Which brings us to the first of the Eightfold Path, which is?
Right view.
Right view. What would you say right view is? Or right perspective, right outlook, right understanding?
Just have an understanding of what we're talking about.
Right. Yes, indeed.
Can I read somewhere where right view has the Four Noble Truths embedded in it?
Yes, it does. Right.
Yeah.
It's an understanding of the nature of experience as unsatisfactory. The nature of the cause of suffering in experience and that there is a way out of that. That's kind of intellectual understanding of it, and that's fine. In fact, it can be a useful, skillful way to describe it. How would you say that you experience it?
Experience the right view? Is that
what you're asking? We're not even right view. How do you experience view?
Cling to it, usually.
You can, certainly.
I was thinking maybe just acceptance of what is, like that's how you experience. Like, to have right view is just to accept that everything that's happening is the way it is.
Well, I'm actually asking a slightly different question. How do you have the experience of view?
Sometimes I know I have a bias. Sometimes it actually can be, you know, it's almost like a meta-awareness of almost a contraction around how I see things.
Mm-hmm. It's still
two
not
different
there.
Questions. Yeah. How do you know you have a view, and how do you know the view is the right view?
Two different questions.
Yeah. How do you're asking, how do you know you have a view?
Right.
Well, I'd say I can view it. I'm organized. I'm selective and organized.
Selective and organized?
Yeah.
Can you expand on that?
Oh. Well, I choose what to place within my view,
mm-hmm.
and I choose how to relate the things I place there to each other.
Okay.
So in a sense, I'm saying it's a fabrication.
Okay, good. Getting closer.
I think it's making a necessity. Right? I've experienced view as if I make an assessment of things that I see or experience.
Oh.
Okay.
I have a view based on my conditioning.
Right.
And it may or not be reality, but until I investigate that with my mind, I don't know the difference, perhaps.
Okay.
So would a right view be a view that is unconditioned? Or is that possible?
It may not be possible, but you've not answered the question that I'm asking. You know view through sensory experience. So the body takes in the world, the eyes take in the world, hearing takes in the world, emotion takes in the world. They all come together and you form this understanding of the conditions of the present moment. Then you have a thinking response to that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Where is, almost before thinking is assessment of threat? I mean, that's one of the things that we're doing.
Well, let's look at it through the process of the four foundations of mindfulness. The first foundation of mindfulness is body-mind, the capacity to sense. When you look at sensing, we talked about this morning, you have the capacity to sense, the object that can be sensed, and they come together, the forming of consciousness around the sensing, and then the knowing what it is. So the five senses form the experience and then the mind knows what it is. Most of the time, because of our conditioning, by the time it enters consciousness, we'll already know what the experience is. There are very few examples that you can work with directly where you wouldn't have that happen. And one of the ones that I like to recommend is exterior sound. Listening for sounds in the soundscape that you don't know what they are. If you can find a sound that you don't know what it is and it lasts longer than a half a second, it will actually enter consciousness and you'll be able to watch the process of the mind trying to identify it. It will over and over again try and match patterns to it. If it thinks it's matched it, it will stick, and then if something indicates that it isn't, it will release and the next one will be stuck on until it identifies what it is, and as soon as it does that, it's nearly impossible to pry them apart. The only time I really manage it is when I'm sitting a long retreat that I can pull the two apart. But in practical day-to-day life out here as householders, if the mind knows what it is, it'll enter consciousness with the knowing what it is embedded in it. You won't be able to separate them. Remember that the mind, the conscious experience runs a half a second behind what actually happens. It takes 150 microseconds to process something that's categorized as urgent. I would say We talk pleasant, unpleasant, neutral because that's the translation that we have in English. I prefer to use urgent, doesn't matter, and pleasant. Because the urgent stuff is always put in the head of the line. The pleasant stuff it has a secondary experience. Happiness is actually a cognitive function which is left brain oriented. Stress, in a stressful situation, the first line of defense is for the brain to shut down cognitive ability because so much distress and experience is self-generated that the mind shuts off that. If you're stressed and you don't feel any happiness, it's because happiness is a left brain function, and even in a moderate level of stress, the brain will shut off the cognitive ability. You've heard statements like, I can't think straight. That's because you're stressed and your cognitive mind is shut off. And then it comes back on, and you know that because you can be happy. So it's a great gauge. Can I feel happy or can I not feel happy? If you can't feel happy, you're too stressed. So, the first foundation, the sensing. The second foundation is the categorization of urgent, doesn't matter, pleasant, which happens in the brainstem. So all of the sensory awareness goes into the brainstem, it's categorized, and then that's processed through into consciousness, which is the third foundation. That is to say, the knowing what it is. So, consciousness is probably a bad translation, but it's the most common one for the third foundation. It might be more awareness. It enters into awareness, which is neutral. But it enters as a consciousness. So the passive sense and the object that can be sensed, when they come together, they form a consciousness of that experience, which awareness can be aware of. The consciousness has all of the capacity of emotion and sensory richness. Awareness is just neutral. And then the fourth foundation is all of the kinds of reactions that come to it. Have you heard the metaphor of the two darts? Mm-hmm. The first dart is the categorization of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And the second dart is the reactivity to the original experience. So you could have an unpleasant experience, bam, the second dart of aversion arises. In relationship to it. So craving, aversion, and consciousness is fourth foundation, whereas pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral is second foundation. They're different. We're talking about view. So the sensing and the reactivity to the sensing experience. Conditioning can distort view at a very basic level. When did you first learn that fire is hot? How did you learn it? You burned yourself. Didn't like it, probably. But now, the body's conditioned that if it feels heat, it withdraws. That's conditioning. You don't think about it because it happens. If you had to wait a half a second to remove your hand, you would be severely burned. So now the body simply does it. So you need to be sensitive to that kind of conditioning that's inherent in the early part. And then the second part is the response to it. So you're standing on the corner and a car veers wildly out of control and heads straight at you, and you leap out of the way in a peak of anger. And then the car continues to drive off, and then you run down the street screaming up. So you can't get out of anger in the first sense. The body is an inherent quality. The body reacts to anger and you leap out of the way. The second, anger is completely optional, right? So you have your conditioning. You can recognize the conditioning, whether it's useful conditioning or not useful conditioning. This is part of the investigation into this, into understanding view. I was talking earlier this morning that the mind makes snapshots of things, and it can use old snapshots. For instance, motorcycles with a single headlight are 9 times more likely to be in an accident than a motorcycle with 2 headlights. The most common response that drivers of cars say when they run a motorcycle off the road is, "I didn't see it," or "it wasn't there." And it isn't that it wasn't there, but when the mind made up the experience of the world, it didn't include it. So you need to begin to understand that how you perceive things, how you believe that your perception of the thing is actually the thing that's there, in fact, you've made it up in the mind. How's that sitting? It's even worse in some ways than you might think. So, particularly if you add memory to this. Yeah. How long do you think that you can actually accurately remember something?
2 seconds.
Depends on what it is, too.
So, often with a high emotional content, there's a greater memory. It's one of the uses of emotion. But the actual truth of the matter is that with detail, the longest you can actually remember something is 8 or 10 minutes. After that, it's encoded in an algorithm, which is called a GIST, that then when you want to remember something, you simply replay it in the same place that you recorded it. But it's stripped of all detail. So when you remember a conversation you had with somebody 3 weeks ago, you are actually making up the dialogue that you remember in the moment that you remember it, because memory doesn't encode that. It encodes what you understood the meaning of it was, with no detail of what was actually said. So that you can emphatically believe that they said this, and then you said that, and then they said this, and then you said that, but in fact, you've made it all up in the moment that you remember it, based on what you remember the meaning of what they said to have been. The reason I'm pushing on this pretty hard is this is actually right view, the understanding that you don't remember it, that you're remembering the gist of it in that moment that you remember it. Then you re-encode it. So if you've remembered something 3 times since the event happened, you don't remember purely the gist of what happened. You remember the gist plus the gist plus the gist plus the gist. So you even have people looking at the videotape of what happened and saying, "That's not what happened."
But then Mark Twain that said something like, "Some of the worst things that ever happened to me never happened."
Right, exactly. Or my favorite, "The worst winter I ever spent was August in San Francisco."
That's right.
If I was just up there, it was freezing.
There's a wonderful, I can't remember if it's Science Writing or This American Life, where they were looking at eyewitness, like, lineups of identifying people who perpetrated accidents, and whether you could actually have even seen somebody that you identified in a lineup.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, I guess, it's really nice to begin to see the science of, no, you didn't really see them.
Well, and they're beginning to completely disqualify lineups.
Yes.
Because
yes.
The chances are, if you don't have a diverse experience, that you will not be able to recognize the face of somebody who's a different face. You just won't be able to do it. Because there's a whole piece of the brain that just translates faces, and you learn to do it as a child, and if you're only experienced to the race of your family and your community, and it's homogenous, you don't have the capacity to decode the facial features of another race, kind of race blindness. It's one of the reasons that the xenophobia is so strong in that way. The racism is so strong because it's a defect in your capacity, and rather than look at that as a defect of your own facility, you reject it in a kind of racism.
It's them, not me.
Huh?
It's them, not me.
Right. So, in terms of you, you begin, to get a sense of how groundless the ground is that you're on. In the beginning, this can cause fear, it can sometimes cause misery, the sadness that actually what you perceive and remember you've perceived is not actually that accurate. It can cause disgust. Nothing lasts. I can't count on anything. And so you come to a road in which one direction is nihilism and in the other direction is engagement. Suddenly makes the experience of the present moment so much more important to fully engage and not to reserve from, because once it's gone, it's gone. You can't get it back. And if you haven't fully engaged in it, the richness that you can have from that, you don't get. And there's no way to get it back when you can't remember it.
What do you mean by you can't get it back?
This moment ends. And if you reserve something from it, you can't use it later. Does that make sense?
I'm still kind of trying to...
What I'm actually advocating is that you get to the point where you can go all in every moment, because that is the place of the greatest richness. If everything that you reserve from that present moment experience, there's never another occasion to go in with it.
I think I was hearing what you were saying almost as it's like a trait. If you lose that capacity, you've lost it forever, but that's not...
No, it's the present moment.
You're talking about the moment. Okay.
There is only the moment. Have you noticed that? There's never not this moment. Mm-hmm. And there is only this moment. There's no past, really. There's no future. There's just this moment over and over again. In one direction you can go, well, nothing lasts, I don't really know what's going on, my perception is of such limited capacity, there's no point really in engaging any of this. And so I'm going to go home and eat potato chips while watching TV. This is a very popular choice, you know. You're laughing, but it's a very popular choice. I'm just going to distract myself from this. What is it about the present moment that's so unbearable that you can't stay in it, even though it only lasts that long? It is the suffering that's possible in that moment, isn't it? So we again come to right view to begin to see these things so clearly. So, do you know what the metaphor that the Buddha used to describe right view was? One of the stories he used. He said that the mind does not experience anything directly; it experiences them as a reflection through the senses. In India, 2,500 years ago, what was a mirror?
Through a glass of
water. It was a bowl of water. Mm-hmm. You looked in the reflection of the water. And he says, it's right view as it is as if it were a bowl of water. If the mind is clear and free of distortion, the water is still and you see a very accurate reflection of the way that the world is. If the mind is filled with lust, the word, it's often translated as lust, but it's a cognitive craving. If the mind is filled with craving, grasping. And it's as if the water were dyed bright colors. And so when you see the world reflected in it, you see the distortion of the bright colors included in the experience of what you see. if the mind is filled with hatred or aversion, it's as if the water were boiling, and in fact, you can't get your face close enough to it to actually have any real idea of what's going on. So if you notice if the mind is filled with anger, you actually don't have a good idea of what's going on. You need to still the mind. The mind is filled with sloth and torpor. You know what sloth and torpor is?
I know what intimately.
Yeah.
Sloth is the tiredness of mind, torpor is the tiredness of body. It's as if the water was overgrown with algae. The mind is filled with restlessness and agitation. It's as if a breeze were blowing across the surface and it's causing a distortion. If the mind is filled with doubt, it's as if the water were muddy. So this is poetry. It's kind of a wonderful metaphor. But I ask you again, how do you know what your view is? You're seeing it. You're hearing it. You're feeling it in the body. That's you. And is that view distorted or is the view clear? That's what is important to know. Because what the Buddha says is that in the times when the view is clear, you remember how that looks. And when the mind is filled with distortion, you remember how that looks. So that you can tell the difference between when the mind is distorted and when it isn't. If you know how a distorted view looks, then when it's present, you recognize, oh yes, here it is, distorted by lust. Oh yes, here it is, distorted by hatred. Oh yes, here it is, distorted by doubt. We were talking about doubt this morning. What does the experience of doubt look like in terms of the body? In terms of how does actual visual space look differently when it's filled with doubt and when it's not filled with doubt? Remember, in the exercise we did this morning of pulling the threads apart, a lot of you described a moment of multiple threads coming together to form experience. Is that an accurate statement on my part? That this little piece of touch experience combined with this little piece of emotional experience combined with this little piece of internal visual thinking combined with this little piece of auditory thinking come together in a moment of belief that form the perception of what you're experiencing. This is you. Does that make sense? So you want to be very clear, is this little piece of touch experience clear or is it distorted? Is this little piece of auditory thinking clear or is it distorted? Because when they come together in a moment, the world looks totally solid. The floor looks solid. The experience of yourself experience it seems solid. And yet if it's completely distorted, it will look the same. Am I making sense? It's hard to tell the difference between a distorted view and a clear view if you haven't paid attention to what clear looks like so that you can compare it to distorted. And so you want to be outside of the identification with it so that when it arises, when it manifests, you can say, oh yes, there's the view of the world complete with the distortion of hatred. Oh yes, there's the distortion, there's the picture of the world complete with the distortion of craving. I'll give you an example. You go out with your spouse, you look across the room and you see them talking to someone and you're completely flooded with jealousy and you storm over there to demand why they're flirting with somebody. And they say, I don't know who they are, they wanted to know where the bathroom was. In that moment of jealousy, you saw the world the way that it was, and you believed that it was an accurate representation, and you went over to act on it, which created a karma. Karma is action. So So intention and action. So with view, you want to, again, pull out into awareness to notice the arising of this. So there's a few things that you can do that will help with this, because most of us rely on the perception of sight to create this picture. When you look around the room, is everything in focus and sharp? No? What is it? When I, in this moment, if I look around, it looks all sharp to me, looks all solid.
It depends on where in, you know, what part of your vision is. I mean, yes, that window's solid, but there's something blurry over here that people
Okay. So you're talking about what you actually see, which is different from the assemblage that the mind makes out of that.
Definitely.
Actually, the eye goes around the room in a Brownian motion, and it picks up snapshots of focus. And then the mind forms a vision of the room in front of us that's completely in focus. That isn't actually what's there. It isn't even what we see. It's what the mind makes out of it. So you've probably worked some with sight space, and so you've broken that apart. Actually, if you don't form the world into a solid place, what your eye is actually seeing is a very pixelated, glowing experience of light and dark and color, and that the mind actually forms the perception of the solid world, and it's completely made up in the mind. So when you begin to see the difference between what you actually experience and the formation that the mind makes out of it, this is again investigation of view. When you get into the habit of doing this, you don't accept automatically the presentation of the world. You begin to see it. Is it clear? Is it accurate? Or is it distorted? And by what is it distorted? There's tremendous freedom in this because it informs the intention and the action that you take. If you accept the world that's manifested, and you accept it with the distortion in it, and you take an action based on that distortion, and you create a karma that comes from this place of distortion. If you recognize that the world that you're forming in that moment is grossly distorted by hatred, and you know what the view of the world is without hatred, then you can form the intention to take the view from a clear place, and then the karma you create is coming from a clear, undistorted place. Does that make sense? So this is why the view and intention is so important, and spending some time in seeing those kinds of things happen. Any questions?
So how do you make that leap? Say you realize, okay, I'm really angry and seeing things from this perspective. How do you make that shift? Or is it just the awareness of, like, ooh, I better, like, watch what I say or do because I know I'm so angry?
That's actually a very... It's a good piece, which is the cognitive piece, which is important to begin with, but then also there's the formal practice of meditation to train yourself to pull back into awareness, not to operate from that total identification, which will require a practice of equanimity around the arising of sensory phenomena and the sensory clarity about which pieces are which. We have memory, right? Memory is triggered. Why is memory triggered, do you think?
We need to survive in some ways. Like, we need to remember who was.
Right. So what you're pointing to is that the arising of a sense of self is a good thing, right? For instance, you're all listening to me speak in English, which means you've all manifested a sense of self that can understand English. Because if you were sitting purely in no self, you would simply be hearing sound with no meaning associated to it. The arising of self is not a problem. In fact, what you want is the arising of an extremely skillful self. a brilliant sense of self, a big, gorgeous, marvelous sense of self. And then when you don't need it, you just want to let it disappear. And then the next time you need it, you want to manifest it again. This is actually freedom to come and go from the experience of self. And in some sense, ultimate freedom is to be able to come to a fully manifested sense of self and then disappear into cessation and then come back. So it's a good question you asked, and it's about the practice of meditation around awareness of sense of self, sense of world forming from these strands of sensory experience, and then the conditioning associated with them. The reason that memory is so likely to be triggered in this process is that it's about recognizing patterns. So you have one pattern of behavior, you categorize it, this is all automatic, and then the mind or the brain stores similar patterns in similar locations. So in this process of encoding memory, it's like dropping a bead on a long thread of similar beads. It causes a resonance in that. So it often evokes memory, which colors experience. To overcome conditioning, this needs to be examined, this categorization process needs to examine and held with equanimity. So if you hold something over and over again with equanimity that was aversively held, then it becomes more neutral. If you hold something over and over again that you were craving, it becomes more neutral. And so there's also a quality of renunciation that comes. You need to renounce the craving, which is this desire for something, and also for this holding back. The other is the process of unconsciousness. Are you familiar with the process of unconsciousness?
No.
Something happens, there's a reactivity to it. The mind, body is making a decision about how to respond to it. If you can't hold that experience with equanimity, then it may unbalance the mind. And if the mind is unbalanced, it will go through its process of regulating, of rebalancing itself. And basically, what you'll be using are the tools that you were trained with when you were an infant on how to regulate your emotion. Most of the time, that involves the mind turning on a story which generates an intense emotional experience which is masking or dampening of the original reactivity to the underlying experience. If that process becomes too intense, then the mind just pushes the whole thing into unconsciousness and you don't remember it. You probably had the experience of coming to, not remembering what you were thinking about. Do you know that? Daydreaming, coming to, something happened.
Is that where you also get fragmentation if it's too big of an overwhelming experience where things get kind of stored?
Right. Well, you're talking about sort of an extreme form of dissociation. Dissociation in itself can be sort of not like that. If you're talking about those kinds of splits in memory, it has to be pretty extreme. And really what it is that you get into one level of experience, it's overwhelming, and then to another, and it's overwhelming, and to another, and so you never have the continuity of memory. But the splits have to be really deep in order for there to be no connection between them. So how are you doing on this? It can be kind of unsettling, this kind of conversation. Is it all right?
I've just been wondering for many, many years, because I've sort of seen this through introspection for many years. Well, okay. Well, all right. Well, so what relationship then do I have to this? Nihilism is not appealing, though it does seem to have a certain kind of integrity. I'm interested to hear you say a bit more about the other path
to completely engage with no reservation, just to go all in every moment. So in some sense, we're talking about generosity here. You go all in with what you have. You don't go all in with what you don't have. So, in the practice of generosity, you say that there's three levels of practice. One is to give what you have that you're not attached to and you don't need for your survival. One is to give what you have what you are attached to and what you don't need for your survival. And one is to give what you have what you are attached to and what you need for your survival. So, in no case are you giving what you don't have, although you often find people give what they don't have because they fear abandonment to the point that they're willing to do that. So, unlike a gambling metaphor, which maybe I'm using with this all in, you're not risking your survival to engage a particular moment unless the moment calls for that. But then you want to begin to see the habit of reserving. We often, this is going back to this experience of abandonment, we often reserve and we often spin and we often present inauthentically, because of this underlying fear of abandonment or this deep aversion to the experience of sadness which is behind that. And what I'm suggesting is that you hold the experience of abandonment, you hold the experience of the grief so that you're free to go in into the moment. You're free to express what the response to the conditions of that moment are in a big, beautiful, fully manifested way, because it's so rich, the experience of it. If you begin to do that, what you notice is that time slows down incredibly, that each moment is richer and deeper and lasts longer. And because you're not constantly pushing experience into unconsciousness, the days become very long, they become full of rich experience. When you come home at night and somebody says to you, so what did you do today? And you think back and can't remember anything that happened, it means that you've pushed almost all of the experience of the day into unconsciousness, so you don't remember it. And that's not a rich experience. But if each moment is filled with this richness because you've been able to stay in the moment and engage it, then you could leave in the morning and come back and it could seem like a month since you've seen them. And there's so many details and so many experiences that you can relate.
How do you hold the, did you say the grief for the sadness so that you can plunge into the moment?
Well,
how do you hold it? What does that mean?
You need to have good sensory clarity so that you can keep it separate from the experience of the present moment so it doesn't color it. So if you're holding the experience in the body of deep sadness and the moment is joyful and you can see them clearly as separate, it doesn't tend to color it. Also, my teacher calls it the pool of poison and pain. If you've ever read Eckhart Tolle, he calls it the pain body, which I also think is a good term. It's some of you are familiar with somatic experiences. It's the somaticized experience which is being held in the body in terms of energy. Because the sadness and the conditioning happens so early, there's often a childlike awareness of it that it's completely overwhelming. But as you begin to examine it now, it's not so overwhelming. And as you take the veil off of it, there's this initial burst of it, which can be quite frightening and off-putting. But then, if you're able to begin to address that experience, really what you're dealing with is a kind of gurgling relief. So, most of the time, that sadness is going to manifest in the body as an emotional center. It's going to be in a specific location. It's going to be of a specific size and shape. It'll be of a particular flavor of emotion. And it will present initially as contractive. some people describe it as a weightiness or a constriction, but it tends to be a deeply contractive energy that's in the body. And so you simply bring attention to it and apply an equanimity technique to it. So you could notice whether you found the experience pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. You could notice the intensity of the experience. Is it a low level contraction, a medium level, a high level of contraction? Often, as you just begin your exploration of this, it's a subtle contractive energy. So you simply let it contract and it becomes incredibly intense, usually in its contraction. You just let it contract. You can note if it's always a high level, subtle changes, increasing and decreasing, same, gone, more or less same, gone. Understand, working with the pool is a long-term project. It's probably months or years in order to release one of these things. And so it can be a grind. There's no other way to really put it. So you work with it when you can. If it becomes too much of a grind, you intentionally don't work with it and work with something else and then come back to it when you're refreshed and able to do it. That deep contraction will begin to open up, and then you'll notice a kind of undulation in the body, almost like somebody's kneading your gut. And then that tends to open up into this like effervescent fountain of energy that's being released. The contraction, this undulation, this effervescence, it's all a form of PT. You know what PT is? Mm-hmm. This energy in the body. So, P-I-T-I. Shinzen calls it flow. But the contracted flow can be really unpleasant. If I get a new opening of this, of that contractive energy, I immediately go to a retreat and I sit there until it moves into the undulatory phase, because I can deal with the undulatory phase with a lot more equanimity than I can deal with the contraction. But if you notice the contraction, you don't address it, and you'll push it back into unconsciousness, it'll just be this cycle of awareness of the contraction and then unconsciousness, awareness, unconsciousness, never really fully releases. The PT is just energy. So it's just sitting with the energy, and then every now and then it will release a wave of intense emotional experience that you can identify the flavor of. So just sit with the contraction and then watch to see if you can recognize what the emotional experience that's being released. So depending on the conditioning of your experience, you will have different emotional centers around all of these. Some people have a kind of, they're kind of tightly compressed in the same area. Mine are sort of spread out. And I haven't found any pattern in people of how or where the energy is stored. It could be anywhere in the body. Base emotion tends to have no image or audio associated with it. It's just energy in the body. So anger, fear, sadness, disgust, contempt, surprise, happiness. Complex emotion does tend to have imagery or audio associated with it. So you'll have releases of energy and there'll be flashes of image. There'll be words or sounds associated with it. But it won't be enough to form a narrative. And you might notice the habit of the mind to form a story to explain why you're feeling this way. Understand again that that's something you're making up in the present moment that may not be included in the experience. And so you begin this process of releasing.
I'm thinking about your comments on not holding anything in reserve for the present moment, and I think it's a beautifully expressed way of how to live. The thing I'm trying to reconcile is thinking about planning and discipline, and could you comment on, you know, those two?
Sure. It's slightly off this topic. Are you happy with that answer? Is it enough?
Yes, I'm happy. I was thinking when you said in the moment and sort of wholeheartedly each moment that there was some great technique. Here's sadness, here's grief, and you can still plunge into the moment. So what I got from what you said is it's a long term.
Right.
development.
One of the great things about the sitting with the pool and pain is that once you've released it, it's actually gone. Heraclitus said you can never step in the same river twice. So as you, let's say sadness, big release of sadness. And then a few hours later, another big release of sadness. It's not the same sadness, it's two different ones. And it's being released. Depending on how the constellation of your conditioning is, you'll have different centers. People hold different experiences. Some people are fearful, they have a lot of fear. Some people are For most people, sadness is the big one. Some people have anger, some people don't have anger. Some people have shame, some people don't.
I just wanted you to clarify what you mean by centers. You mean actual physical locations in your body?
Right.
Okay.
For instance, I've been sitting with regret for, it's coming up on 3 years, and it runs right down here.
What?
Regret.
What were you sitting with?
Regret.
Regret, okay. And I have specific places where specific emotions are centered.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So, and are they contracted?
Yes, yeah.
So that's the pool.
Sure.
And you have more than one, even in the same place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It really depends on your conditioning and how you held what you held. Shinzen, and I have been having a running dialogue about this because for the last 20 years I've been releasing this stuff and he used to say to me, yes, just get enlightened, it'll all resolve itself. This last October I was sitting with him in Arizona on a retreat, and he finally said, you know what, you're going to have to do the pool work, it doesn't resolve, so there's no way out of it.
Pool, P-O-O-L?
Yeah, yeah, the pool of poison and pain.
Okay.
So.
A pool, not a pool.
Pool of.
Pool.
That's the pool of the pool.
The pool of poison and pain. I just call it the pool, but Eckhart Tolle calls it the pain body. That's a good one.
So I think it might be helpful too to hear, we were talking about this, that, the pool is there, and in this process, though, your relationship to it changes.
Right. Okay. Good point. So, in the beginning, it can be quite terrifying, and it seems overwhelming. And then you take the veil off of it, and you see what it is, and you understand that even in its most intense working an equanimity technique with it, say, you can hold that experience in consciousness without it becoming overwhelming. And then it becomes what I call the gurgling process. It's just constantly releasing, constantly releasing. Good sensory clarity. You keep it separate from the experience of the present moment so you can have the joyful present moment even though you're also processing this. It's a long-term strategy. I can give you... I started with anger because I had so much anger that people would make an empathetic connection to me and they wouldn't really want to continue it because I had so much anger, and their own experience of my anger was so unpleasant for them that they would keep their distance. And I recognized this as a problem in me having meaningful relationships. So I sat with anger. It took about 2.5 years, and it released. In the final stages of the release, there's like a huge energetic expansion, which can be quite frightening as you first experience it, and that tends to shut it down. So you just let it go. I was sitting in a group, and I was sitting in a chair, and somebody was... Actually, I was sitting over here, and there was this huge expansion, and I flew it up my chair and landed in their lap. Kind of a good surprise.
Was this after a lengthy retreat, or
no?
Just
this is just a Tuesday night sitting group.
Wow.
Then I sat with fear, and I thought, oh, so the anger went. It changed my whole landscape of relationships changed because all of the relationships I had that were interested in the fear, in the anger, when I no longer had it, they just left. It's like the flower had closed and the bee moved on. And then fear arose, and I thought, oh, crap, how am I going to sit for 2.5 years with here. Yeah. I got through it in 6 months, and I was thinking, I'm such a good meditator. I whip through fear.
Uh-huh. When you say you work with it, you meditate, is this a specific type of meditation?
It's really what I described, just bringing awareness to the energy in the body and holding the energy with some equanimity technique.
And how it feels.
How do you find it in the body?
Do a feel-in practice where you're just looking for emotion in the body, and if it's there, your awareness of it will arise.
So just keep trying to find it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I don't have any landscape emotionally in my body yet.
Okay. So noting feeling states technique is the one for you, and I'll describe it. So then sadness came up, and I said, I'll whip through sadness in 6 months, no problem. Such a good meditator. And then it took like 5 years to get through sadness, and it was really hard. Really, really hard. And then nothing. No emotional centers. And I thought, I'm free! Then shame arose. And I thought, oh my God, 5 years of shame! This is just going to be unbearable. And I got through that in about 18 months. And then I thought, I really hope I'm free. And helplessness arose. Helplessness was really hard because I could tolerate it for such a short time, I couldn't even get a technique on it. It would come into consciousness and be gone. So the first probably 8 months was just trying to hold it long enough that I could get a technique on it. And then once I got a technique on it, it went pretty quickly. And so now I've been sitting with regret for about 3 years. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting is that all of the ones prior to regret were aversive. Regret is about desire, about craving. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like I finally got through the aversion piece, and now I'm craving it. And it's so different in terms of how it manifests that it's really, for me, entertaining to be working on it, as opposed to just working on aversion, which I had so much of before. But it's also incredibly freeing. One of the things about sitting and concentrating on PT is that it's in some sense a way into the jhana. The first jhana is you apply your attention, you sustain your attention on PT, and what arises in reaction to that is sukha, the opposite of dukkha, pleasantness or bliss. So you often find in doing the pool work that bliss arises in reaction to it. So you have this grind, this release, and then this bliss that comes. So it's definitely worth doing.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because I was thinking that in my own experience, sitting with difficult and painful emotional type sensations in the body, when they do start to flow, when they loosen up and they're not gripping and solid, in my experience, there's actually a pleasant, that actually can become, I think Shinzen likes to say, it massages you.
Right. Exactly.
And it does. It feels like, you know, when things are moving and flowing, there is something that can be quite pleasant about that, even with, you know, fear or anger or sadness or any of those.
Now, please answer your question again.
Sorry, yes. The question was about not having, holding a reserve.
Yes, I got it. I remember now. All right, so engage with planning. And so there's a difference between the economics of the macro and the micro. So you're fully engaging it every moment and not reserving what can be given into the moment, which doesn't in some ways affect the overall picture, which you're still engaging in, understanding that in that moment you can do this that affects the overall plan. Does that make sense? But not more. There's no part point in worrying about what you can't do in this moment that's going to affect the overall plan. You need to reserve that for the moment when you can actually do that and it's appropriate. Does that make sense? It's perfectly reasonable to plan, but only the planning that can be useful in the moment is useful in that moment. There's a difference between planning something that you're actually going to do and fantasy planning, which is a way of regulating your emotional experience. Does that make more sense?
Yes. Say that again, please.
Yeah.
There's a difference between planning the thing that you're actually going to do and are engaged in doing, and fantasy planning, which is a way of regulating your emotional state.
Is that like a form of self-soothing or something?
It is. And it's related to attachment. Most of the time, the best way to regulate your emotion when you can't, when it's out of a balance and you can't easily bring it back, is to regulate it in connection to someone else. So you connect with someone else and they help you regulate your emotional state. If you had the conditioning of a child where that wasn't a possibility, then you cooked up these elaborate strategies to balance yourself, which involve a lot of these self-soothing activities, which are in the end not helpful because they only work while you're engaging in them. Who likes to watch an entire series of television back-to-back episodes? So you know what I'm talking about. You need to regulate your emotion. You watch an episode of TV, it regulates it really well, and then when it's, because it's a distraction, it only works while you're distracted. As soon as you're not distracted anymore, you're back to being unregulated, and so you watch another episode, which works really well until the episode is over. And then you're back to being unregulated, and so you watch another episode. This is the groundwork for addiction.
Can you say something more about what you mean by unregulated?
That you have an emotional state that's off-balancing. Don't know what I mean.
Well, I'm wondering if there's a more precise definition of unbalance.
Intense emotional experience that obscures the present moment, prevents you from inhabiting the present moment.
Is regulation like the way that you work toward equanimity?
Yeah, the mind has to regulate itself. What do I mean precisely? Maybe this is a better way. The brain actually has a very narrow range of the saturation of neurochemicals which it can tolerate. If the saturation gets too high, then the receptors are damaged. If it gets too low, they don't function. So in this highly stressful moment, the body is dumping adrenaline, noradrenaline, it's dumping cortisol, it's dumping neurotransmitters. If the saturation of that gets too high, the brain, in order to protect itself, will begin to shut it down. It will shut off cognitive memory, it will shut off the limbic system. Anybody who's suffered depression knows that the limbic system is shut down there. There's an absence of feeling. It doesn't feel good. But it's really an absence of feeling rather than active feeling. The brain will shut itself down all the way to the point where it shuts off the brain stem in order to protect itself. That's dysregulation. If the brain stem is shut down, you don't form any memory, so it's called amnesia. When the level of neurotransmitters is back, and really a big upset takes about 20 or 25 minutes for the liver to filter out all of those neurochemicals, so you come back into balance and the brain turns all of those sections back on, and then you're back in regulation. Is that a better definition? The experience of this is that a gradual loss of function. When you're super stressed, you don't function very well. For instance, I used to manage a restaurant. It could get incredibly stressful, and at the end of the night I would have to close out the books. There were some nights I couldn't do it. So I would just lock everything in the drawer, and I would come back the next morning, and I would do it in 10 minutes or 15 minutes. But the night before, I, no matter how much time I spent on it, I couldn't do it, because the stress had shut down those capacities. So that's another aspect of right view. What's working? What isn't working? How are you experiencing the world?
I think I understand, and I really like the kind of fantasy planning, which is real planning. But I was still thinking about this regulation, and the one example I could think of, and it's a very trivial one, but it's like physical activity, and where in the present moment you could do more at that particular moment, and actually it would be more fulfilling, but it will wear you out, so you can't do it tomorrow, the day after. And I'm not sure if this is relevant or not.
So you're reserving your participation in the present moment because of the idea of something in the future?
Yes, so that I have energy tomorrow to do so.
Okay. Well, I guess you could make that choice. You could go all in the moment, and then when the moment came in the future and you examined your energy level that you had, then you could still go all in. You would just have a different level of energy.
Right.
Uh-huh.
It seems like so much of what you've just been saying, it almost makes it seem like, you know, whether it's awareness, but it's just everything's so dependent on biochemical happenings. Do you know what I'm saying? The liver and the stress hormones and not being able to think all out,
right,
which I totally relate to, but...
Have you noticed that you live in a body?
It just seems like, wow, I get the sitting and sort of seeing it and observing and noting, but it just seems like, wow, I'm just almost at the mercy of all these reactions, and all I can do is like notice. Here's one, here's one.
I'm glad to hear that you're understanding what I'm saying. Right. So you're getting the unnerving part of this. I may not have a clue what I'm actually experiencing. That's what I'm trying to get across to you.
But the other part of that, I went to a workshop this week about the brain we have in our gut,
right,
on the nervous system, and how it impacts on those, all those. That
I posted on my site an article that the formation of the flora informs how you experience the world.
Right. Yeah, and so the upshot of it is what you do does matter. I mean, you know, that's part of being in the moment, is that that's your right intention, is that you recognize that what I'm doing in this moment, whether I'm over-exercising or not, I know that.
Right.
And if I'm eating the right food, I know that.
Right.
And I'm not there, but I understand intellectually that that's possible.
So one of the things, I'm going to relate this to attachment, because I like to talk about attachment experience as view. Oftentimes, you recognize that the distorted view is there, but you don't remember what a clear view would be like, so you can't figure out what to do. So this is this process of learning. What is a skillful action to take? To answer in more depth the question about regulation, we learn to regulate our emotion from our caregivers. Mm-hmm. And so we need to examine whether the tools that they gave us are skillful or unskillful. If the tools are skillful, then we need to foster them and develop them. This is the sixth of the Eightfold Path right effort. If the skill that we got was not skillful, we need to prevent the mind from using it to regulate it. If, for instance, my mother was a rager, so I learned to use rage as a way of regulating my emotional life. If I experienced sadness, the mind would automatically generate rage, as a way of regulating the experience of sadness. If my mind was fearful in reaction, my mind would generate sadness to regulate the fear. So you can see the pattern of matching. This tool arises in relation to this experience with that effect. Right effort is four pieces. One is to recognize when an unskillful mind state has arisen and to stop it. The second is to understand the root cause of the arising of the unskillful state. So when we're talking about this in relationship to emotional regulation, if you react to the experience of the present moment with fear and then the mind turns on sadness, the root cause of this is a lack of equanimity with fear arising. And so you bring to that an equanimity technique to hold the fear and prevent the self-generation of sadness. So the first two, recognize when an unskillful mind state has arisen and stop it. Recognize the root cause of the arising of the unskillful state. The third is to recognize the arising of the skillful state of mind and foster it. And the fourth is to understand the root cause of the arising of the skillful state of mind. In some sense, this is heart practice. If you notice that in reaction to the present moment, sadness arises, and then you notice that the mind turns on a story that generates intense anger, you've probably been doing this your whole life. You have maybe a handful of themes that will generate intense anger in the mind. You could probably name them. I recommend giving them amusing names. It helps with the disidentification. So I have one I call talk show, where I'm pontificating about the state of the world in an enraged manner. I have one I call the ranter, where I'm just ranting, you know. But four words into a rant, my whole body is filled with rage. To recognize this unskillful state of mind and prevent it. So because the emotion is generated by thinking in words, you stop the words from playing in the mind and replace them with forgiveness practice, which is what I use. I use a phrase called, I love you, keep going, to replace rage in the mind. Because the rage prevents me from taking action. And I need to be able to take skillful action. So I love you, keep going, encourages me to take action. So you can invent phrases that are useful to the framework that you have.
Mm-hmm. What was the fourth one again?
To recognize the root cause of the arising of skillful states and to foster them.
Let's see here.
I think we should do some meditation. Why don't we do some meditation and then take a tea break? What do you think? Insight practice. So you're going to want to position the body in a posture that you can hold still without moving. So essentially what you're doing is straightening up the spine and balancing the body so you use the least amount of muscle power. Relaxing the body. Always a good idea to do a quick inventory of the body. It's part of this settling process. So starting at the top of the head, relax the scalp, the brow, the eyes, the face. Let the jaw go slack, relaxing the tongue. Straighten the spine, balancing the head. Relax the shoulders. Just let the arms hang down, arranging the hands comfortably. If you're sitting in a chair, plant your feet so you have a good solid base. And if you're sitting on a bench or a cushion, arrange the legs so that they'll be comfortable for the period of sitting. Just let the breath go in and out as it will, no effort to control it. So we'll begin to examine emotional experience in the body. So bring your awareness into the body, excluding all feel-out sensations, so the effects of gravity, of temperature, of respiration, circulation, digestion, and the efforting to hold the posture are all excluded. We're just looking for patterns of sensation which represent emotion. So for some people there may be almost no awareness of emotion. And so what we're doing here in doing this technique is requesting that emotional experience be allowed into consciousness. For some people there won't be good facility at regulating emotion, so there's always a hyper-awareness of emotion. So here we're attempting to bring equanimity to the experience of emotion so that they're not so activated. And for some people you'll have a good way of regulating emotion and they'll just come and go. Much more matter of fact, that's fine. What we're really looking for. So keeping awareness in the body, you may notice that emotion related to the present moment plays out on the surface of the body, the face, the front of the throat, the front of the torso, the inside of the arms, the inside of the legs, tends to be vibratory in nature and pass through rather quickly. Doing this technique also tends to activate the pain body or the pool of poison and pain, emotional centers. Deeper in the body, these tend to be in a specific location, which is stable. They tend to be of a consistent size and shape. They tend to have a single flavor of emotion, and they tend to be contractive, at least initially in their appearance. Thinking is excluded, so visual thinking, auditory thinking are excluded. Exterior sound, exterior sight are excluded. No need to repress, no need to try and stop. All of those other sensations can go on. They're just left to go on in the background. No attention. In the foreground is patterns of emotional experience. If you can recognize the pattern of experience, you can label it by name. So you let your attention freely float in the space where you experience emotion. As it's drawn to a particular flavor of emotion, you can call that flavor by name. So base emotions, anger, fear, sadness, disgust, contempt, surprise, happiness, complex emotion, really quite varied, individual to individual, love, joy, bliss, humor, interest, longing, loneliness, regret, remorse, guilt, shame, so on. You may be aware of a pattern of emotional experience, but you don't know what it is, in which case you can use the label something or don't know. And there's always the possibility that there is no emotional content present at any given moment, in which case you can use the label none. I'll do a little out loud. Interest. Fear. Humor. don't know. Sadness. Humor. Something. Sadness. Sadness. You get the idea. So we've been working to develop sensory clarity with moment-by-moment emotional experience. We're going to make a subtle adjustment to the technique to work for equanimity with emotional experience rather than sensory clarity. So we're going to continue to restrict the object of meditation to sensations which are emotional in nature. But this time, instead of noting for sensory clarity what particular flavor they are, we're going to note for equanimity using a pleasant, unpleasant, neutral strategy. So let your awareness freely move in the body, focusing on patterns of experience which are emotional. And note whether you find that experience pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. So this is Vedana or feeling tones. This is the automatic categorization, not the reactivity to the emotion. As it enters consciousness, it includes a category of whether this is a pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral experience. We're looking for that. So you don't have to think about this. It's just what's already embedded in the experience. If you think about what your reaction is, then actually you're working with craving, aversion, and unconsciousness, and not pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, or urgent, doesn't matter, pleasant, depending on how you like to formulate it. So keeping awareness in the body, touching emotional experience as it arises, noting pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, if there's no emotional experience at any given moment, just use the label none. Don't need to know what it is, so something or don't know can still be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. I'll do a little out loud. Neutral. Unpleasant. Neutral. Neutral. Unpleasant. Pleasant. Neutral. You get the idea. So, in some sense, equanimity is the absence of craving, aversion, and the desire for unconsciousness. So as you do this, you may notice that sensations which have been pleasant become neutral. You may notice that sensations that were unpleasant become neutral. This is the way in which the conditioning is changed. Because the Vedana reflects the conditioning response, the conditioned response, rather than the conscious reactive response. comments or questions on that?
Unless I actually try to call an event up, I don't have emotions that arise.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if I should be concerned or not.
No. No need to call anything up. It's just the inquiry itself. It may be that one of the things that you do as a strategy is to just keep awareness as unconscious. And so simply doing the inquiry will begin to bring emotional awareness into consciousness. It may also be that sitting here now, peacefully and calm, no emotion arises because there's no need for the body to prepare to take any action, which is actually what the experience of emotion is. In some sense, this is a question of practice, formal practice versus practice in life. You sit on the cushion and train the mind to do this so that when you're in life, and there's plenty of things that are coming at you, you have good awareness of what the moment-by-moment emotional responsiveness to that is. The formula for the ratio between formal practice and practice in life is to figure out how much time we spend in formal practice, and how much time we spend not in formal practice, and then whatever the percentage ratio between the two is, how much of the time you should be doing this in life as opposed to in formal practice. Do you understand me to say that you should train the mind so that you're meditating 100% of the time, then you've understood what I've said.
I had the exact same experience, and then also I noticed one time I was having emotion as in response to something that was happening in the room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a sound would come in, it would evoke emotion, or outside, or and then that would bring up a story about something else. So I was very reactive to my external world, like dead zone inside, like I couldn't bring anything up without thinking of something.
In a sense, that's a good insight.
Okay.
That everything that comes at you has an emotional response.
Mm-hmm.
To it. So we live in a culture that's very informed by Descartes. Do you know who he was? A 17th century philosopher who said that thinking and feeling are separate. We don't have this in Buddhism. In Buddhism, when you say thinking, every thought has an emotional component in it. So you want to begin to repair that disconnection if you have it. Everything, in some sense, this is also a good insight because I'm giving you a very restrictive object of meditation, just emotional sensations. Every time something happens in the world that causes the reactivity of emotion, it generally also causes a thought to arise. It's just that because this particular object is so restricted, we're not paying attention to those. But you can certainly, if you wanted to, in another meditation strategy, watch all of that interaction happen. In fact, everything is ping-ponging or popcorning, depending on how you look, in all directions, all at the same time. So I like to, in the beginning, give the instructions that are very limited so that you can see this piece of it. Sometimes it's much easier to pull a little piece out of the whole frenetic thing, and then once you have a good familiarity with it, you can plug it back in and then see how it interacts with everything else.
I have, as Dylan Bruce knows, I have this clinical brain that I have a hard time shutting down. So it's kind of like, okay, this is where I'm feeling it, and that's where my liver is, and then there's the story that kind of comes with it.
Right.
If it's my liver, then it must be anger because, you know, I heard this story that, anyway, I mean, it's hard to sort out what's physical and what's emotional when you're looking at into the body, and the body has all these stories that are in it.
Right. So in some sense we're talking about two different things. One is sensory clarity. So we did touch, feel out, feel in. You may wish to step up and just work in whole categories of feel in and feel out, and just note whether you think the sensation is feel in or feel out. And once you get good resolution between what physical sensations are and what emotional sensations are, then dive into feel in and tease out the individual flavors of it. In terms of the running commentary, you want to limit your labeling to one word. And that will go a long way to get you out of that observing self that's watching. So what you've done is manifested an observing self, and that running commentary reinforces that. So be very circumscribed in your labeling, just really down to one word, and that should help with that.
But it might be don't know if I don't know if it's anger or fear.
If you just sat for the entire 15 minutes and said don't know, and that was actually corresponding to your experience, then you would be doing the technique perfectly.
It's really hard to say don't know.
How about something?
I liked that.
You did.
Mm-hmm. It helped me narrow things down. It worked. Mm-hmm.
It is one of the most useful techniques, and I tend to be a hard science guy. It's been empirically studied to demonstrate that it's one of the most effective emotional regulating techniques that there is. And it has not only the capacity to bring you into equanimity with your emotional experience moment by moment, but it increases the intensity of emotional experience that you can tolerate without it being pushed into overwhelm and unconsciousness. Mm-hmm. So that if you spend, and I'm talking about hours and hours and hours and hours of doing this technique, you can raise the thermostat on your emotional life so that the most intense emotional experience is not overwhelming. So it's incredibly valuable as a tool for emotional regulation. It can completely replace all afflictive emotional regulation systems that you have.
My tendency is to try to figure things out, and that just makes it not very skillful at all.
Right.
And it just intensifies it that way, which is not a good one.
Right.
And this felt very different.
Yeah, absolutely. Wonderful. Uh-huh.
Outside of the meditation hall, I'm almost always basking in some kind of emotion or other. Usually all negative. So this is really going to come in handy for me, because I'm trying to work on really intense emotions without having to use medication, and I can't afford therapy, etc. But as I sat, I was surprised. For one thing, is that the emotional things were split second, like real wispy, and then I would feel a little physical sensation. I was labeling the emotion just to help me be present with catching the emotion or somehow being there with it. And I noticed that there were two different qualities of emotion that would show up in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
But the most distinct emotion and the most distinctly different sensation was melancholy right here.
And what was the energy of it?
It was all neutral, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't negative, which I would have expected. It was just, okay, it's just a sensation.
On the front of the throat.
Yeah. I mean, melancholy, I mean, right there. But everything else was down in the gut.
So, face, front of the throat, front of the torso, inside of the arms, inside of the legs is where most present moment emotional experience plays out. So wonderful clarity.
I want to work with that.
Yeah, good. Anybody else, or is tea calling?
It sounds like often I don't have an emotion unless I'm upset about something. I don't happen to be upset about anything right now. What was helpful for me, at least in getting some way in, was just to sense the places in my body where I know that I brace.
Mm.
So I was kind of sensing into those and then just bringing kind of the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, or urgent. And it was just, there was some new insights that came up around, I mean, one of the things that came up for me was, particularly right here, is, pride. You know, there's a sort of a pride-based management strategy And it was kind of neat to see it, and then what I was feeling is, oh, underneath it is unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kicks in as a way of managing something that I'm not actually accessing.
Mm-hmm.
So it could sort of feel the burbling underneath, and then the, so it was neat to have that.
Good clarity. Good. Yep, it's interesting how we are.
Yeah.
So some of you may notice that there's not much emotional activity, and that means that you learn to regulate your emotion by keeping it unconscious. Some of you may notice that it's just a constant emotional churning, and so you learn to regulate your emotion by churning. Some people may actually have good skills at regulating your emotion and may not notice balance. So that tends to be the spectrum of what you might expect. If you don't have much awareness, it's still the same technique, but you're just going to be doing a lot of something or don't know. And the other, if you have a constant churning, it's better to focus on the equanimity piece, not so much the sensory clarity piece. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we come back at 3:30? Is that going to give you enough time, or would you like a little more?
Maybe 5 minutes more.
Okay. So let's come back then at 20 cal. Does everyone here know what Dropbox is?
Tell us anyway.
Dropbox is a file sharing program. I'm going to upload the recording from the class that we've made. And I'll also put your names and addresses in photographs so they can tell who's just kidding. I will also put in guided meditations that support the techniques we've put in. I'll put in written explanations of the techniques that we've done. And I'll also put in a written explanation of attachment theory.
Wonderful.
If you want to be on that list, here is put your name and email address on there, and please make the email address legible.
And also it will go, we have recorded, we missed George's first hour, which is really sad, but it will be recorded and on the ISC website as well. But not with everything that George is.
So I just wanted to talk a little bit about attachment theory. We talked about attachment in the Buddhist sense, and now attachment theory. John Bowlby was a British psychiatrist who worked in England in the middle of the 20th century. And in the work that he was doing in relationship to treating children who were separated from their parents during the Blitz, he noticed patterns of behavior that the separation caused. So he put an ad in the paper because he wanted a researcher to test his theories, and Mary Ainsworth answered it, and then they began a lifelong collaboration where he basically came up with the theory. And she then tested it so that they had empirical evidence that it was true. And what they discovered was that there were three primary attachment strategies that infants developed. One is a secure attachment. Basically, the worldview, where I'm going to tie this into right view in terms of Buddhism, is that they see the world as a safe place for themselves, that their needs will be met by the world, and that they see themselves as good enough to be able to form meaningful, intimate relationships. That's a secure attachment. Then there was a formation of attachment strategy that is insecure, and in adults, it's called preoccupied. In children, it's called anxious, ambivalent. And these children see the world as an unreliable place where their needs may or may not be met. And so they develop a strategy of keeping their attachment object in view, literally, so that they can be sure that they'll get the care that they need. And then there's a strategy which in adults is called dismissive, and in children it's called anxious avoidant or insecure avoidant. And these children develop the view that their needs will not be met, and so there's no point in putting effort into trying to get them met. When Mary was working, Mary Ainsworth was working, she required a graduate student assistant to help her with the research, and Mary Main applied for the job, not because she wanted to work in attachment, she wanted to work in linguistics, but it was the only position that she could get, so she accepted it. Thinking that one day she would be able to use linguistics in some way. And she and her partner, Eric Hesse, developed the adult attachment interview, which was a way of testing whether or not the attachment strategies that children develop were enduring into the adult life. And what they found was that they were incredibly enduring into adult life. Not only that, but they were transgenerationally enduring. That you can predict the attachment style of an unborn great-granddaughter based on the attachment style of the great-grandmother to a 70% accuracy by interviewing the great-grandmother. That you can interview a woman who is not yet pregnant and predict within an 85% accuracy the attachment strategy of their child based on the attachment strategy of the adult.
This is before or without any kind of intervention or awareness practice.
Right. Okay. Just numbers. That is incredibly stable. The reason I like to talk about this is because we often have an experience of blaming, or we have the experience of self-blaming in response to the way that we respond to the world. And you look here and see that these things are incredibly stable as strategies in family systems. I say this somewhat facetiously, but and I was saying it outside. At 6 months, when you're presented with this insecure and not very great strategy for regulating your emotion, do you have the opportunity to say, you know, Mom, I've considered this. I don't think this is going to be an effective strategy, and I think it's going to be a great disadvantage throughout my life, so I just don't think I'll take it up. Do you have something better? Probably not, right? At a year old, do you think you can say, you know, Mom, I've examined this, and it's not for me. At 18 months, can you do that? Can you do it at 2 years? At 3 years, can you say, I've sort of reviewed how I want my life to go, and these tools for regulating my emotion are just not going to get me where I want to go. So I'm going to do something else for myself. Where is the blame for yourself in that? Anywhere? Can you find it? I can't find it when I examine myself. And then you look at the caregiver. Where did she learn the tools for regulating her mood that she then knows to pass on to you? She learned it in the same circumstances that you learned them from her caregiver. She couldn't have refused them either. But she did grow up She may even have decided that I had a crap childhood. I'm not going to do that to my own child. Who of you have children? How stressful is that? What's the first thing that the mind shuts off when you get stressed? The cognitive mind. You don't have that to offer in a stressful situation. And raising children is incredibly stressful. What you have is your implicit memory, which is where those strategies for regulating your emotion are stored. How do you translate this regulation to a child? It's basically right eye to right eye transmission while you're holding them, attempting to read through an empathetic connection what their experience is, and then teaching them how to identify what that experience is, know how to regulate that experience. Where is the blame in that? I can't find it. Even if it's really an unfortunate and bad outcome, it's hard to know where that is. Now, I'm looking around. There are no children in the room. Have you noticed? Who's responsible for retraining the mind if your skill set isn't the greatest? Are we going to look to our caregivers? At what point did the responsibility of our caregivers lapse? And who is responsible then to take it up? We are responsible to examine the skill set that we have, and if we find it unskillful, to retrain the brain. There's no advantage to blaming in this. Blaming will not retrain the brain. There's no advantage to not retraining the brain, because if you don't retrain the brain, these strategies are incredibly stable. They will not move on their own. Does that make sense? So we can't do nothing, and we can't blame other people or expect them to do it. We are stuck with what we have unless we are willing to change it. And the good news is that it's plastic, and the mind is plastic, and you can change it within limits, which is I'm actually still having a hard time with that aspect of it. There are some developmental windows that, if missed, are basically missed. And if that happens to be your condition, it's much better to face that and understand that that's the case. In some circumstances, you'll find that the strategies that you have for regulating your emotion are not useful, and that you can't regulate them yourself, and in which case, then you're going to have to rely on your inner circle of people to help you do that. And so you're going to have to be willing to let them know in a meaningful way that this is something that you require. So with an intimate partner or with a close circle of friends, you can rely in that case on the outside support to help you with that kind of regulation, and you can go your whole life in that relationship using that as a support, and it will be effective. You just may not be able to do it on your own. So that's kind of the hard reality of it.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, because one of the things I've wondered about is the ways we can use Sangha and Kalyanamita spiritual friendships for that kind of support. Mm-hmm. That's been one of the questions I've been asking about this Sangha, and could it grow into that kind of...
With the people that I work with, I explicitly tell them that they may end up having to do that, and that they need to ask people to help them with that. And what I find is a useful pairing is two people who are in the same situation. They probably don't need to regulate the same thing, but they both need some kind of external support. I also, particularly with the people that have no awareness of what their emotional life is, as it comes into consciousness, I pair people and have them describe to the person the feeling state that they're trying to identify, and I have the other person mirror it back to them. This might be this, or it might be that. And that seems to actually work very well, and it also takes a lot of fear out of this process of opening up to that experience. Obviously, the conditioning that caused you not to include that into consciousness was very charged at the time, so when you release it into consciousness now, it often comes with some charge. We are not children. We don't need to be overwhelmed by the intensity of experience that overwhelms children. Do you understand that? That's another aspect of you. We're adults. We can manage this much better than we could at the time that this stuff was pushed into unconsciousness. As it emerges into consciousness now, understand that you are not subject to the conditions of then. You have the conditions of now to work with. Eric Hesse discovered with Mary Maine that those three categories actually didn't cover the full range, and that some children are dissociative, and this is an unresolved category in adults, or disorganized, unresolved.
Still?
Yes.
Or that they are that way?
They're still unresolved. And some children develop a dual coping strategy, which are mutually exclusive in a sense. That is to say, they develop both a dismissive or dismissing strategy and also a preoccupied strategy. And so those people are called fearful avoidant as adults. Fearful avoidant is a very... I'll give you an example. I walked up to one of my students who's fearful avoidant, and he completely blanked me as if he didn't know me. Mm-hmm. I know him very well. There's no way that he did not recognize me. I have a beard, you know. So I said, okay. He's completely blanking me. So I turned to go and talk to someone else, and within 10 paces he spun me around and said, where are you going? That's like a classic fearful avoidant response. No acknowledgement, and yet the overwhelming terror of being abandoned when the person responds in a normal fashion. What's interesting about this is you begin to look at yourself to see what kind of strategy you use, and then also you can begin to look at other people and see what kind of strategy that they use. The attachment strategy is a hardwired evolutionary instinctual response to the world. They've done a number of studies on this. How long is it, do you suppose, before this attachment mechanism goes off in life?
What do you mean goes off? Turns off?
At what point in the development of an infant does it turn on after birth?
As in when is it set?
When does it begin?
Before birth.
There is some research that's going on to see if it actually goes before birth, but they've tested it consistently. The first indication of attachment in an infant is 42 minutes after birth.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's also the first one.
There's a wonderful film called What Babies Want, which I actually have a copy of. We could do a Dharma movie night with it. And it's about that. Mm-hmm. Beautiful film.
42 minutes, the baby makes the first mimicking of the expression of the caregiver in an attempt to elicit a connection.
So I have a question for myself. I was taken away, like, right away if I was sick. Mom didn't even seem like the first 3 weeks
right.
to come in.
So
now it makes no sense. No,
right. So that would have been traumatic if you couldn't bond with somebody. Yeah. They understand better now than they did. But so a lot of the caregiving in the birth process in institutionalized medicine was very contraindicated to this kind of thing, the recognition of this. 42 minutes in, we're already needing connection. Mm-hmm. We need this connection. When you look at a small child, what do they do? What is the physical manifestation of their desire to connect?
Well,
mimic? Well,
they hang on to their
once they can.
They put their arms up.
If
you just look at a small child, they'll just be standing there, no one else around, nothing really happening, and all of a sudden, they want to be picked up. This is the indication. Completely placid, normal, blank expression on the face, no outward indication. Internally, they need this, they put their arms up. What happens if nobody comes? There's a bewildered expression that appears on the face of the child. I put my arms up. Why is nobody picking me up? Nobody picks them up, and there's a whimper that comes out. Most mothers are so highly attuned to the sound of their child's whimper that I know this because I have God kids, and I'll be standing there talking to mothers. I won't hear anything, and all of a sudden, one of them in the group will go. And then go off looking for the kid. The whimper doesn't get responded to. There'll be an intermittent plaintive cry. Just a single cry out. Usually that's enough to get the mother and the father in high gear because of the terrible tantrum that is at the end of this chain. If nobody answers the intermittent plaintive cry, it turns into a continuous cry. If nobody answers the continuous cry, it turns into a tantrum. Because this is all driven by neurochemicals, once the child has gotten to the point of tantrum, it will take about 20 or 25 minutes to calm the child down, because that's how long it takes the liver to filter out all of the chemicals that are driving this tantrum. Child puts up his arms, it cries, the parent comes, the parent picks it up. If you get to them before the tantrum gets in, you could hold them for 20 seconds and they would be fine to be put down and go back to play. It's just a resetting of the mechanism. The only thing that shuts it off is connection. The connection mechanism goes off, you connect, the connection mechanism turns on. You connect, it turns off. Pretty straightforward. If it gets all the way to tantrum, then you have to really hold the child and help regulate this as they process the tantrum until they're calmed down, and then they can go off and play. You may notice, if you watch adults, that the same mechanism happens in adults. It just can look slightly different. It can also look very much the same.
With a tantrum at the end.
Stomping feet, slamming doors, breaking dishes. It looks just like a tantrum.
Do you know how that gets derailed? I'm thinking of Spock movies. I was one of those where it's like, whatever the cry was, it's not going to be until 4 hours have passed that picking the baby up is going to happen.
Well, unfortunately, that tends to lead toward a dismissive orientation that their needs will not be met, so there's no point in trying, so the baby basically gives up trying. Not a good idea.
A lot of people our age have that.
Yes, and worse. Some of those, the just let the kid cry all night strategies, which were so awful. All of the statistics show you that if you pick the child up with complete conscientiousness in the first year and regulate their mood, that they'll be much easier to handle for the rest of your life. That they'll be able to self-regulate, they won't be as distressed, they won't cry as much, they won't be as oppositional. So the better you are in the first year of grabbing them when they need to be held and then letting them go, this is both. You know, the baby throws a huge fit, you pick up the baby, and then 10 minutes later it wants to be put down, and you're thinking, I'm not putting you down, I put all this effort into this. So it's the picking up and putting down. A lot of times when the child wants to be put down, there's a resistance to that because people get into a craving situation around that adoration that the children have. So, if you look at it, so what they recognized in this was this disorganized child, and it's a particular experience. What happens is the attachment mechanism goes off, and at the same time the fight or flight mechanism goes off. And the fight or flight mechanism prevents them from connecting, and so they can't shut down the tantrum. So the child is in a frozen tantrum. Very distressing, very difficult for the experience of the child, also for the caregiver, because the children are unsuitable. And if you see as a small child a child that just collapses on the ground and makes no movement toward an attachment figure and just howling, that's what that is. In the adult, it's very similar. The attachment mechanism comes on, the fight or flight mechanism comes on, and because they can't connect, the distress around the attachment just keeps escalating and escalating. So the frozen tantrum, a lot of suffering in that. So these are the basic attachment strategies that are out there. They're very stable, they've been empirically studied and tested, they're very reliable. So as you begin the exploration to examine yourself and your strategies, and also the strategies of the people that you relate to, can be very useful. If you're dismissive, you develop the world view. If we equate this directly to Buddhism, you see the world as a place, you experience the world as a place that will not meet your needs. You see other people as incapable of meeting your needs, and so there's no point in trying to satisfy them. These people tend to be great explorers. They tend to succeed very well in terms of material acquisition, because they don't make room for other people and they don't experience the harm that they cause other people in their ruthless achievement, if that's what they get into. You might also see them as narcissistic. That tends to be how they picture. They're completely concerned with themselves. They don't really make connection to other people because they don't see the point of it, except to get what they want, satisfied. They have no problem exploiting or manipulating because they don't actually ever register the pain of other people. They tend to use a derogatory anger as a coping strategy. They devalue. So they devalue other people, they devalue anything that really conflicts with their worldview, and they have a tendency also to overvalue. So if they're in a relationship with you, they devalue the attachment needs of the relationship, they overvalue the fantasy possibility of a better relationship somewhere else, and they're very controlling. The preoccupied people are very concerned about the location of their attachment figure, and they tend to constantly pester for reassurance that you care about them. Because that they become so preoccupied with the other person, they basically abandon the pursuit of their own interests and their own lives in favor of keeping track of the attachment object. So these people underachieve. They often couple. The second most popular coupling is a preoccupied person with a dismissive person, because the preoccupied person is willing to give up entirely the pursuit of their own life in favor of keeping proximity to the attachment figure, and the attachment figure is indifferent to their constant heckering because they don't make that kind of connection. So it's a utilitarian bond that is not intimate. Secure people are actually the hardest to detect because it's so varied in the way that they present. They see the world as a place where they can go out and actually get their needs met. They see other people as people who will meet their needs. They're not so frightened about a relationship dissolving because they see the world as a safe place and other people as meeting their needs, so if one relationship goes, they can just get into another relationship. It makes the connection very secure. They assume that the other person will meet their needs, so they don't need to hector them to do it. The other person, typically secure people get into relationships with secure people. If you're single and out there in the dating world, the person that you're most likely to meet is a dismissive because they don't form lasting relationships, so they're always available. So, I'm giving you sort of an overview of this. If it interests you, it's actually worth doing a little bit of study on yourself and other people so you can get a sense of this. But related to the Buddhist right view, if you see the world as a place that's going to meet your needs and other people are going to meet your needs and see you and be kind and really like you the way that you are, then you're probably secure. If you worry and the mind perseverates around whether somebody cares for you or not, or whether the relationship is secure, you're leading in the direction of preoccupied. If you diminish the value of connected relationships, and you're very good at exploring, but you always do it alone, then you're probably headed in the direction of dismissive. The bar for a secure orientation is pretty low, so you can have a crap childhood and still come out secure. There are certain kinds of abuse that tend to lead to an insecure outcome. Without some kind of direct abuse or trauma, it's very unlikely that you'll be unresolved. One way that you can understand unresolved is that secure people and insecure people do pretty good in life, and if you're unresolved, you don't do nearly as well. And the reason for this is that frozen trauma, that frozen tantrum. You could be going along really well, and all of a sudden something knocks you off base and you can't respond. And if you're in that position and you're dealing with a secure person, after a while a secure person will interpret that as you're not interested in them, and they'll move along. Dismissive people don't notice, really, and preoccupied people go crazy that you can't respond. So you often see unresolved people with dismissive people. So it's not really an intimate relationship, it's just a kind of bond. What is the underlying defect here? So, I'm going to give you a quick quiz. What is it that I'm describing? Glib and superficial charm. Grandiose, exaggeratedly high estimation of self. Need for stimulation. Pathological lying. Cunning and manipulativeness. Lack of remorse or guilt. Shallow affect. Callousness and lack of empathy. Parasitic lifestyle. Poor behavioral control. Sexual promiscuity. Early behavioral problems. Lack of realistic long-term goals. Impulsivity. Irresponsibility. Failure to accept responsibility for own actions. Many short-term marital relationships. Juvenile delinquency, revocation of conditional release, criminal versatility.
Dismissive.
What? Sociopath. What is the underlying cause of sociopathy? Well, there is that. If they're born with a defect in the mirror neuronal system, then they're going to be a sociopath because they're incapable of what?
Empathy.
So, this is a defect of empathy. And often these underlying attachment strategies are a defect of empathy, so that they can be repaired by repairing empathy. Turns out that Buddhist practice and meditation is really good at repairing empathy, really good at developing compassion. You've probably heard that. So the question then is, what's empathy? Right. So I actually told you the answer to this this morning, if you remember. There are three things. There's an empathetic response to physical pain, witnessing physical pain. There's a cognitive ability to know what the other person is experiencing. And there is a, through the mirror neuron system, a generation in your own body of what the other person is feeling. So healthy empathy is all three of those. Sociopaths typically only have the second. They can read you, but they don't feel pain in response to your pain, and they don't share your feeling experience, so that they're free to manipulate you. If they're able to generate an emotional experience that matches their presentation, you'll check in empathetically with them and it will match so that you'll trust them. It's one of the skills that makes them so effective at manipulation. So again, in terms of right view, you want to check that, but you don't want to rely on it as the truth. You have to compare it to everything else.
They're good con people.
Yeah. Good con people. So what do you need to do in order to make an empathetic connection with somebody? We're all so far in the room capable of doing it.
We need to let ourselves be vulnerable.
Before that. All right, I've just checked in with everybody. Everybody can do this. What is it that we're doing?
Look at the other person.
We're attuning. It's called attuning. So attuning is the process where you place your attention on someone else and they place their attention on you, and you're able to hold the connection. Have you ever been around small children? What happens when they attune to you and they find the experience overwhelming? They turn away and to the left. It's always to the left. Somehow it's wired in the nerves. And then when they regulate their emotional experience, they come back and they reattune. Have you seen this in children? It's also true of adults. If you make an if you attune to somebody and the emotional response that comes from that is overwhelming, they break the gaze. Now, we do have social conventions in terms of staring at people and holding their gaze. I'm not expecting you to contravene those, but can you hold an empathetic? Can you hold your attunement with somebody without having to break the gaze? If you can't keep the attunement, it's because you can't regulate the emotion that comes up in the process of attuning. In order to make an empathetic connection to somebody, you're going to have to be able to attune to them. And if you can't regulate the emotional response to that, then the place to start is in the regulation of the emotion in relationship to attunement. Nobody here seems to be having a big problem with it. But you often find that. I'm working with somebody now who's in their late 60s. They've never had an intimate relationship because they can't attune.
But you can attune without eye contact.
Well, I'm going to say no for the purposes of this. You need to be able to hold somebody's gaze and regulate your own emotional experience if you're going to move into this.
I'm just thinking that prolonged eye contact is not culturally appropriate in some cultures, and then there are also people who can't see or can't see well, and they can still attune.
They do, but they attune in a different way. You are in this culture and you're sighted.
Something that just occurred to me that's kind of interesting is, you know, we do this prison work at Salinas Valley State Prison, and as a result of one of the people that goes in with us having an experience up at San Quentin, we started doing a practice of everybody standing in the middle of a circle. This would be about 8 to 10 men. And just making eye contact and bowing, acknowledging the fact that in prison that can be scary and difficult, and anybody who feels uncomfortable with it did not have to participate. Everybody chose to. And it's amazing. We've seen individuals who have made huge changes, just sort of setting up the circumstances that made that safe. And also just a different feeling in the group of a sort of a bonding and secure place. So this really is an attunement exercise, mm-hmm. as I look at it. Been very powerful, actually.
So you attune, you were very sensitive to attuning. You can probably see a person a block and a half away staring at you and recognize that. This is, again, a hardwired evolutionary aspect of the spacesuit you're currently trapped in. Then we foster the empathetic connection. We allow the connection in ourselves, and we hope that the other person allows it in them. Then you make a strong empathetic connection. If you can't hold the experience of the empathetic connection, you'll either end the connection or you'll attempt to adjust the person so that you feel differently. If they're sad, you'll try and cheer them up. If they're too excitable, you'll try and calm them down. This is not compassion. This is manipulation so that you feel better in this process. Compassion comes in where you're willing to hold the empathetic connection, you're willing to hold the attunement regardless of what the condition of the other person is that you're holding. If you have the experience of being seen and held in this way, it's a remarkable experience. If you have the experience of the empathetic connection and the attunement being abruptly shut off because they don't like what they're getting, you also have the awareness of how dislocating, how estranging it feels. So, 14, an even number of people, that's a great thing. I want everybody to pick a partner and sit facing them. Oh, you do? She bailed on you.
Can you do a threesome?
You can do a threesome. Oh, now, what I want, what I want is for one person to call out a number between 1 and 20. And then I want the other person to say that number as fast as they can, and when you're fully attuned, you should be saying the number simultaneously.
Wait, would you say that again? I don't think I understood that.
I want one person, and but then we'll switch. One person will call out randomly a number between 1 and 20, and then the other person will say that number out loud. Both of these are out loud, as fast as you understand what the number is.
First person is quiet after he throws the number out?
Yeah, one person says, say, 7, and then the other person says 7, and then the first person, the caller says, 9, and the other person says 9.
1 through 20.
One person is calling, and the other is the responder. The caller calls numbers between 1 and 20 randomly, and the responder responds with the same number as fast as they can.
And we keep doing this?
And you keep doing this. I will. We're going to go for 5 minutes, and then I'll ring the bell, and then we'll switch roles. So, again, it's a formal Tirunam meditation, so there's no talking beyond the calling of numbers.
One.
Feel to be attuned. Would you say that was a good feeling?
I'm sweating.
You're sweating? But you're laughing.
Yes.
You seem joyful.
Yes.
What's the experience of attuning like?
It's fun. It's hard though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to attune. Were you able to get it to the numbers either simultaneous or close?
Sometimes.
To be fully attuned, you would just be saying the numbers one after the other together. Why is that possible? Because conscious awareness runs a half a second behind what's happening. So that the mind can hear the number, process the response, and respond, and by the time it enters consciousness, it appears as if you were doing it simultaneously. Mm-hmm. But you really have to pay attention and focus and really be in attunement with someone else for that to happen. In order to be in an intimate relationship, you have to really be able to attune to somebody. It's a little bit of an artificial situation that I put you in, because this was not about counting. This was about attuning. If I had asked you to stare into each other's eyes and attune, you would have been so self-conscious you wouldn't have been able to do it. But here, where you think the task is about counting, it sets aside the self-consciousness and you're able to attune. It feels pretty good. Anybody in terrible despair having attuned.
Did the instructions include maintaining eye contact?
They didn't.
Okay.
Were we counting or just doing random numbers?
Random numbers.
Okay.
Yeah. I say it's counting because one person calls and the other responds. So. Anyway, you're right. Bad choice of words. Now, we're going to do another exercise. We're going to have one person sit with their eyes closed and do the noting feeling state out loud. And the other person is going to look in their body for the emotion that the person is calling out to see if you can begin to identify the location of the experience of the empathetic connection. Does that make sense?
These will be the specific labels rather than the feeling labels.
Right. Do you not have a partner? You have one now. So do you understand the instruction? I'll ring the bell. One person will sit with their eyes closed and do the noting feeling states technique out loud. So they'll report what their emotional experience is out loud. The other person, sitting with their eyes open so that they can attune, will then look in their own body for the emotional experience that the other person is calling. So it's as if somebody else were labeling your noting feeling states technique. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm.
And it's not neutral, pleasant, and unpleasant either. It's
no.
Specific,
it's a specific label name of a particular emotion. If you don't know, you can say something or don't know. Remarkably in this, the other person may know because they can recognize the experience that you don't. And it could be none, and you could also be saying none, and the other person could also be detecting an emotion because while you don't allow it into your consciousness, it's still in your body and still can be picked up by somebody else.
Sorry for all the questions, but eyes closed, eyes open?
One person, eyes closed, one person, eyes open. The person who's calling has eyes closed, the person who's receiving has eyes open, and then we'll switch.
And the receiver is just receiving, they're not saying anything. Just receiving.
Right. Anybody unclear about the instruction?
So it's just like saying, like, I'm aware of what you're feeling, you're noting, feeling.
Right.
Kind of on a continuous kind of flow. So
right.
What's happening? Okay.
Here we go.
Thank you.
Okay, switch roles, keep going. Yeah, we're just going to switch roles. So one person, the person with their eyes open is going to close their eyes and start calling their emotional experience, and the other person is going to attune and investigate in their own body whether they can identify the empathetic experience by what they're calling. No. It's just exactly what we were doing, except switching the roles you were in.
Thank you.
getting there.
Experience of compassion differ from the experience of attunement?
It's harder.
Yeah, it's harder. How was it to sit and not try to adjust the feelings of the other person in any way? Okay?
I find I immediately wanted to manipulate the emotions to see if I could trigger something. I also started to cry as soon as Bruce said fear and anxious, I started to cry. I mean, and then I started to get overwhelmed. And then he shifts the calm and I'm left with.
Yeah, so my process was that I was anxious. I felt very vulnerable expressing my, current emotions. And there was fear and anxiety, but just staying with it and expressing it and all that, it over time, it took a while, but over time it shifted. Mm-hmm. It shifted to calm and it shifted to joy and happiness. And so that part was very interesting.
It's like hanging onto a roller coaster.
but that's an insight too.
It is.
What a roller coaster our emotions really are. They're all over the place, all the time.
And how challenging it is to just hang in there,
just
with
be
somebody
with
else without wanting to fix them.
I didn't want to fix it, but I felt myself just responding as if I were saying, meaning it was a total response. And then I also noticed just that Leela would say something and I'd hear a bunch of other people saying the same thing. And I thought, and it wasn't always this, the same, it would shift around, so it was quite interesting. I felt affected both by what she said and by what I heard.
Mm-hmm. Good.
I found that it was kind of easy to step out of the fix it when I was listening and feeling, but when I was having the feelings, I really wanted to fix it both for me and for her. Okay, how can I get out of this? Mm-hmm.
So there's an insight of where to work.
I'm just going to turn this up. This is negative, this is sad, this is bad. Let's see if we can find
an alternative to
the
that.
Kernel, the sweetness within the pain.
Not allowing yourself just to be. That's self-compassion that's missing.
Yeah. Well, when you try and name it that, and it's like, okay, there is some compassion, I'm feeling that compassion, and it's like, oh, but it's painful.
Yeah, can be. And if somebody's really in distress, it can be really hard to manage. What else happened?
I found when I was listening, when I was the one noting, yet wanting to maybe edit a little bit, because I was aware of how you could hear someone or even across the room, so it didn't feel as intimate with just me and this person. Then you know, corresponding feelings would arise.
The desire for inauthenticity arises.
Right. And then just naming that, labeling that. But so that's one thing I noticed. And I think I did get over it. And also the feeling of, like, there was a calm abiding, and then it would veer off like that, like you're saying, authenticity versus inauthenticity. And how coming back to whatever it was, whether it was calm or safe or, you know, the words that I was using. And then the other piece, when I was the kind of observer of the connector, the empathetic kind of connector, really being able to resonate and attune with her kind of pleasant, neutral, and positive emotions, but the negative I wasn't really connecting with.
Mm.
And then being like, why? And then questioning, like, getting in my mind about it, like, why can't I connect with that? And then, oh, never mind. Just kind of coming back to, this is what it is. You know, oh, there's, I can feel the calm or the whatever, the kind of positive or the kind of soothing or the, but the others I wasn't really connecting with.
Mm-hmm. Good insight. Mm-hmm.
I found myself saying, I don't know a lot, because I knew there were lots of things going on, but I couldn't quite get to what they were.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what that means, but just that...
It's just a matter of sensory clarity and actually sometimes through intuition you'll know, but if you consistently don't know through intuition, then you're going to need to elicit help from somebody else.
Right. I kind of know that about myself. So how do the words you choose to describe it, how do they influence what happens?
Well, did anybody notice that somebody was describing an emotion and that you felt it, but mm-hmm. it was a different emotion than you would call that?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
That happens quite a bit because mm-hmm. we're schooled in what that particular mm-hmm. experience is in our family systems, and two family systems could relate the same experience differently to their children. So that's an interesting thing. And also, the idea that you can lie in an empathetic connection is a complete delusion. Whether you're willing to admit it or not, the other person, if they're well attuned to you, will feel it. And they'll simply compare what you're saying to what they're feeling and decide that you're inauthentic. That's how we decide whether somebody's inauthentic or not. So the idea that you can lie about the empathetic connection is pretty much a delusion unless you're a skilled sociopath. So that's an interesting. So this idea that you can successfully be inauthentic is also being called into question. Something has to happen where one person simply is agreeing to go along with the convention, even if they may understand it.
Yes, I think we're really learning how to be authentic, so we're going to miss it sometimes.
Absolutely. I like to be emphatic in pushing you toward authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I behave the way I do.
You're being authentic.
I'm willing to be abandoned.
Yeah, the one part that I felt bad about is that when Bruce shifted from fear and anxiety to calm, I felt some kind of, wait a minute, you just had me crying, and now you're going to be calm. I don't believe it. And the other thing is I was just amazed at, I mean, how many varied emotions within 5 minutes a person can feel.
Yeah, just as a constant flow.
It felt like a this.
And
I couldn't even, sometimes I couldn't even say it because it was so ephemeral.
Mm-hmm.
It was just
more than one
flipping
thing
like
say
this.
I think you had a question.
Oh, I'll say, sharing a question. It's interesting to me that contributed is centered on the negative emotions, like I would have a reaction and destroy the positive ones. And then when I was noting, I didn't have any emotions in meditation, but then I started to feel anxious that I wasn't sharing any emotions, and then I had an emotion of anxiety.
Yeah.
Which is so helpful, I guess. But I was
good
also,
insight.
But it also did make me wonder, like, and then I found myself thinking a lot of trying to understand, like, do I really not have emotions, or have I suppressed them to be, you know, unconscious? And it became very almost intellectual. That, and I don't really know, you know, do I really not have that many emotions coming up, or am I suppressing them?
I'm going to go for the second until the first is proven.
Okay.
It's a very common conditioning as a child not to express emotion. The only way that we can do it as children is to not have the awareness of it.
So I just want to loop back to something I asked you about this morning. Just a small amount of self-disclosure. I live with somebody that I believe to be on the autism spectrum. And sometimes when we talk, I feel like he misinterprets what I say and makes it worse than it is. And when he says things to me, he doesn't really get it that they're hurtful.
Mm-hmm.
And that empathy loop, it's kind of crazy to me in a way. That it's like, you know, it makes me feel like I have to be really... I have to learn a lot more about right speech and say things, you know, in the kindest way whenever possible. But at the same time, it's kind of like sometimes it feels like there's just not that feedback loop where you really can feel like you develop empathy and empathetic relationship.
One kind way to put it is, I'm not feeling very well connected. Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can't connect. That goes a long way to solving that. If the other person is open to that, then if they're not open to that, then you see that they're not willing or able to make the connection. Mm-hmm. And so you can begin to take less personally their actions in terms of your feelings, because they're not actually sensitive to what they are. So they don't know that they've hurt your feelings. They don't know that they're continuing to hurt your feelings. They're not connected. But I don't know why we have such an aversion to saying things like, you know, I'm not feeling very well connected. One of my favorite slang sayings is, do you feel me? Which is all about that. Do you feel me in your body? Have you made the empathetic connection to me or not? All of these things are the process of authenticity. I'm not connecting well to you. I am not, right? It's not, you're not connecting to me. There's something wrong with you because I can't feel the connection. It's, I'm not feeling connected. What can we do about that?
I had a good experience with that with my sister the other day. We usually have a good relationship, often do. And she was just not there when we were talking. And I called back later and I said that very thing. You know, I didn't have a very good feeling of connection. And then it really led to a very good conversation.
Mm-hmm.
It was very satisfying.
That's great.
Do you remember how the attunement felt?
Mm-hmm.
This is the underlying, that nice, pleasant, connected feeling really is the thing that you're looking for. Another thing you can do, particularly with attunement, if you're having a conversation with somebody and you notice they're constantly distracted, just stop talking. You'll be amazed how fast the attunement comes back, because they don't understand why you stopped talking and they need to check. Even stop in the middle of a sentence and watch them come back. Make sure that as you're saying the thing that you need to say, that they're actually attuned. You can tell. If they're not attuned, you can tell that they're not attuned. Don't say it louder, or don't repeat it, or don't do all of the things that we do to try and compensate for the lack of attunement. Wait until you're attuned, and if you're not attuned, don't say it at all.
The person I've had this difficulty with will clearly, in my opinion, not be there, looking away, whatever form of distraction. And so I do recommend it. And he'll say, "Why don't you stop talking?" And he's really wanting an answer, so I tell him. And he says, "Oh, I can repeat verbatim what he said."
And could he?
Yeah.
He could. So he's intellectually listening, but he's not attuned.
Right.
Yes.
So you just say they're not the same thing.
Yeah. Right.
That, you know, I mean, it isn't the content of communication often, it's the connection that we want. Mm-hmm. Somebody, your attachment mechanism will not shut off even if they've heard what you said and they don't connect, so you'll still be in distress over it. So you may find those situations as unsatisfying and you're still in distress because without the connection your attachment mechanism keeps going, demanding connection. You know, I the other night I went to a dinner party. It was a terrible dinner party. Nobody could connect where shit. Bad. And by the end of the dinner party, I was in tantrum. So I had to go to a friend's house and sit with them for 20 minutes so the tantrum would go away. And we didn't talk about anything. It was just being in the company and attuning so that the desire to connect that all night long was activated and unsatisfied would turn off. That's why sometimes when you get into a crowd of people, it's so distressing to be in the crowd of people because you're not actually landing. If you find that you're developing your intimate circle, the deal you make, this is really the underlying deal, is that when you need to connect, I'll receive the connection. And in return for that, when I need to connect, you have to receive the connection. It doesn't matter what the circumstances are. It doesn't matter whether I'm happy or sad or indifferent. If you receive my connection, then that drive, that distress to connect will shut off. And I'll feel that pleasant feeling of being attuned. And that's very valuable to me. And because of that, if you do that for me, I'll do it for you. And it's a great deal to make for people because often it doesn't take much to do it. It's just that real connection. It often works better in person. The phone is hard to do it. With Skype is somewhat better, or some kind of seeing that reaction.
You mean texting is not a good way?
Facebook. These are all distractions that put off the need to connect until you can actually connect. But if you have enough people around you, and how many is that? 3, 4, 5 people that will receive your connection when you need to, and that you'll do the same for them, you're very well taken care of in that way. It never really gets distressing because you simply call somebody up or make the arrangement for connection. If you're in an intimate relationship with somebody and you live together and you're willing to do that, then you're pretty even most of the time because every time you need the connection, you can get it. This is one of the things about being a herd animal. We need this. And we can't often do without it. One of the things about, for instance, you know the term hungry ghost? It's a Buddhist term. The person starving at the table because they have a pinhole mouth and they can't actually eat. Insecure attachment is like that. The preoccupied person frantically trying to connect, never really attunes, never really forms that connection, and so their attachment mechanism never goes off, so they're in this state of distress the whole time. While the dismissive person appears to be totally calm and not in need, unconsciously, their emotional sense is in that state of tantrum. With small children, they've done EEG tests, and the dismissive kids look totally calm, are indifferent to their mother's comings and goings, but their insides are erupting unconsciously. So
this is a thing in our culture, but it's also an experience, that there are people who appear to believe that if you share a distraction together, that that's the same thing as attending.
Mm-hmm. People believe in God.
I saw this video of babies, and it was an amazing video for me, because when babies are when babies are overstimulated, they turn away, and they showed how baby would be really there for some time, and then they start to get tired or whatever, and they just couldn't take it anymore. And a lot of times the adult was not very in tune with that. And the whole point of the video was to make
the And then they insist
aware.
That the baby re-engage.
I thought, well, I've seen this so many times, and I never like named it. I never really like saw what it was. And I think the difference is an adult can say, you know, I'm really tired. Can we talk about this tomorrow? But maybe a teenager or a young child maybe can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Or certainly not a baby, but...
You know, it's interesting. Securely attached child is typically shy of strangers. They're the ones who hide behind the mother. They're the ones who hide behind the father. They're very slow to warm up. Once they warm up, they're pretty open and friendly. And so we say in our culture, oh, that's a shy child. Come on, go say hello, go say hello. The child that runs right at you and wants to play with you and is very friendly and outgoing, they're insecurely attached. Because if they were securely attached to their parent, they wouldn't do that. They wouldn't need to seek outside of attention with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't be looking for an escape from their current situation.
So. I knew someone like that. She was 7 years old, and she seemed precociously social. And then I found out she had a hell of a life.
Right.
But very... just charmingly, precociously social with strangers.
Yes. So it's also beginning to recognize what actually one thing is and what it isn't, which is often confusing. So we're actually out of time. Thanks so much for coming to this. I hope that this was helpful. And these are my business cards. If you want to get in touch with me, all my contact information is on here. If you like this kind of thing and are interested in morning meditation, you can find out more about it on my website, 6 mornings a week, live. Plus it's recorded and you can get it any time of the day. And it's been very enjoyable to be here.